Coming up today, Microsoft does the old switcheroo on its Xbox One restrictions. Teaming up cockroaches with an Xbox Kinect could be the next big thing in disaster zone mapping, and a team of futurists, engineers, and writers are aiming to create the moonshot thinking to inspire a wave of big innovations. All that and more coming up. The Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to musical forests and medieval manuscript mysteries. I'm your host, Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia _ Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm tired.
Oh.
Seriously, I have not recovered from that festival yet.
Okay.
Wow.
I'm Hellfest.
Hellfest, yeah. I'm still aching. I'm sure parts of me are like bleeding and I just haven't noticed yet.
You're pining for like burning flames and pentagrams.
But let's get on with some news. Now, first, a lawyer in the EU, Liat, has said that Google should not have to be censoring legitimate content.
Yes.
Controversial.
It's quite interesting, really. An advocate general called Nilo Jaskinen, I'm not going to get his name right, at the European Court of Justice, has advised that search engines are not responsible for removing personal information that is legal about individuals. And this relates to the right to be forgotten clause that is integral to the draft going through the EU right now, the EU data protection regulation. So there's a few important things here to keep in mind, and that is that these updates to the data privacy laws that are deeply outdated are still in the making, so can be altered, so this could affect the outcome. And that the judges at the European Court tend to always go with the Advocate General's advice, so it's quite likely they're gonna side with him on this. So this actually all stems from a case in Spain. There's nearly 200 similar cases where people have taken Google to court for refusing to delete certain information that appears about them in search results.
And this isn't like libelous or kind of, you know, just factually incorrect information, is it?
In some cases it has been. In this particular case that he's advised on, it isn't, and that is why he's come out with this ruling. It's the case of this guy who's basically a bit peeved that when he Googles himself, an old news article pops up about how he had to auction his house because he hadn't paid his taxes. And, you know, that's since been resolved, and he doesn't think it should be there because, it, you know, the first thing that comes up when you Google this guy, and it could affect employment and all sorts of things. So basically, the right to be forgotten, it relates to an individual's right to privacy, and things like, as part of this regulation going through the EU courts, tech giants like Google and Facebook should be able to provide you with all the data they have on you. And then there's the kind of right to erasure clause, which is you can decide, we don't want you to have this data on me anymore. Can you wipe it?
It's very, very complicated, though, if you, you know, share a very common name with lots and lots of other people.
Mm. Yeah, well,
maybe
absolutely.
Maybe he should just change his name.
That is another option. I mean, I think this mainly will relate in the future to things like defamatory articles that have to be taken down. Yep. But basically, this guy is saying this isn't Google's responsibility. They are an aggregator. They shouldn't be having to censor legitimate content. This should be down to the individual websites, you know, and their discretion, depending on how the law goes.
True, but there is also the fact that if a website removes something from its website, doesn't mean that it is immediately delisted and unfindable from Google. You know, the Google cache exists for a reason.
Which is why then it comes into place for things like something that is defamatory or illegal content, then Google will do that, and they're willing to do that. But they say that when it's legitimate, valid content that's in the public domain, there's no reason they should start having to censor that, because you can imagine how many,
You don't like a picture
exactly,
of yourself.
Exactly.
The interesting thing about this case is presumably in the investigation of the case, people have to keep on searching for this guy and clicking on the results.
Everyone knows he didn't
thereby
pay his taxes.
Improving the search ranking of this particular result.
Very good point, Liv.
There's another problem. There's a friend of mine who quite a few years ago completed a interview with one of the trashy newspapers where she had to keep a sex diary for a week.
Okay.
Oh.
And she is now a journalist, and she has quite an uncommon name. And if you Google her, and I'm not going to say her name, but if you do Google that name, the very first result is this journalist's sex diary.
Oh, no.
And that's
that is the kind of thing you'd want.
But this is the thing.
But then she did it. She agreed to it in the first place.
Is that something that you should be able to have removed?
I mean, it shouldn't really. It doesn't really make sense to do it. But you can see why she's pee for the rest of, you know, the top three search results for the rest of your life, and that's going to be it, no matter what you do in your career. Imagine if that was always.
I know,
at the
but
top.
Maybe she. I mean, shouldn't have done it in the first place. If she, you should have thought ahead a little bit. I think about that. I don't know who she is, but I feel like that's the kind of thing you should have the responsibility to not do.
Well, and it's if not you've like done a really bad thing. It's just like. If you move into a profession where someone's going to be Googling you all the time.
But also, you just make a website that's super SEO to the max, so you come up first.
We talked about the guy, the guy who can make you disappear from the internet a few weeks ago, who sort of manipulates this sort of stuff. But it raises another interesting point, which is that there are a lot of kids out there putting a lot of stuff on the internet who aren't necessarily aware of these implications.
Absolutely.
Which is why this sort of stuff should basically be part of the school curriculum.
Yeah.
You know, kids know how to use Word and email. That's fine. Forget about that. Let's talk about, you know, Google caches.
Yeah.
And
what happens, because we saw that
how
case with
control your identity there.
The girl who was. Was it a Kent Prime Minister MP's assistant or something, where she'd written some sort of homophobic
and stuff.
She was
like the new police youth representative.
Yeah, and she'd written stuff on Twitter sort of a couple of years prior that was deemed offensive and inappropriate. Yeah. And it all blew up and the, you know, tabloids sort of speared her. And she lost her job and had to apologise. And it was all very messy. And it's the kind of stuff that could be avoided with better education.
Yeah.
But this is all a much bigger discussion than just removing yourself from Google, right? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, well, it goes into this law has been going on for at least a year, more than that, where they've been debating it. And pretty much most US companies don't like the law. And they, because it's going to stick them with hefty fines for things that they think shouldn't be out of their control. I did speak to a guy from Privacy International earlier this week about that Facebook story, where it turned out email addresses had been downloadable by basically strangers for they had this glitch for about a year. And he was saying, people just don't be careful what information you're putting there. Don't put information, which is like a very basic principle that Liv's talking about, you know, think before you post.
And if you go down the route of deleting content that people don't like, you end up with politicians demanding that, you know, unfavorable stories get taken down. It's a really slippery slope.
And course, I think.
I do wonder whether there should be an age cutoff where if you posted something on the internet prior to being 18,
that's interesting.
You could
have it removed.
Yeah.
Because certainly, I mean, I posted stuff on the internet in the early days when I was, you know, 14, 15 years old, that if I saw it now, I'd cringe.
Yeah.
Not because it was necessarily offensive or anything like that, just because it's just crap.
Yeah.
And I'd love to be able to think, you know, you could have a wave.
Or it could say your age, just so it was like, we get it, you know, you were 30.
Yeah. Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Let's talk about Xbox One. Now, when I was out at E3, one of the biggest cheers I heard was not when we were told that everyone was going to get free burgers, but was when PlayStation announced that it wasn't going to restrict used game sales, that you could sell and swap your games with your friends, and that the console was only going to cost £350. Just after, like hours after, Microsoft had said that you basically weren't going to be able to resell your games, that games you buy for 40 quid, 50 quid are going to be tied to your account, and that basically you had to make sure that your console could at least connect to the internet once every 24 hours, otherwise you literally couldn't play any games. Well, Microsoft has reversed its decision on this thinking to more closely align itself with the PlayStation philosophy of freedom, if you like, and has said that the console will no longer need to check for an internet connection every 24 hours to authenticate your game, and games won't be tied to your account, so you can resell your games. You can say to a friend, here's a disc, go and play it, as opposed to before, where it was, here's a disc, good luck making that work, friend.
I love this story.
It's an amazing story. It's basically a PR disaster. Yeah. Sony definitely came out of E3 looking like some sort of champion of the people, and Microsoft did come out looking like an expensive restrictor
and
stick
Microsoft
in the mud.
Went in so ballsy, and we're like mocking everyone for saying this wasn't going to work, and saying, "Oh well, you know, it's not like they're playing it on a submarine and they don't have internet connection." Like they didn't take on board any of these comments. And
there was some really bad stuff that just came out of the PR machine from Microsoft. Like, you know, we have a console for people who don't have internet. It's called the Xbox 360.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just so snipey all the way through, which is why it's amazing.
I do kind of think with that one, though, it's a bit like someone hearing all day, oh, you're rubbish, you're terrible, this is awful, this is bad. And eventually you just snap and say, we've got one. It's called the 360,
yeah,
all right?
Yeah.
Stop it. Anyway, so they've backtracked on this. And on day one, I think this is a good thing because games are extremely expensive and people need to feel confident that if they spend £40-50 on one of these AAA titles, you know, that they can at least resell it and fund the next game. Because like places like Game and Amazon will give you £30-35 for it, you know, if it's a brand new game that's just come out, and you can use that to fund your next purchase is very important.
But presumably it's the games publishers who are putting pressure on Microsoft for this as opposed to Microsoft themselves.
No, because if that was the case, then it would be the same for the PS4. Mm. That's why I expected that, you know, whatever we saw on the PS3 was going to be PS4 was going to be the same for the Xbox.
So what was their reasoning on the not reselling used games? What was their reasoning?
Well, the original reasoning was that you were able to log into any Xbox One console and your entire game library was in the cloud.
I see.
So if you lose the disc, no problem, your game is still there. If you move to a friend's house, you can download the game and play it together. If you have a family member who also wants to play the game and they're on a different console, you can do that as well.
I see.
You know, and that is all very smart and very good and great, but not necessarily on day one and not while games still cost 45 quid a pop. Mm. I do think, though, that what Microsoft was originally promising was, in the long run, a good thing.
Yeah.
We will be relying on the cloud for this sort of stuff. I think anyone who has put a game disc into their console and had an error come up, disc cannot be read and you lose your progress, will feel the freedom given to them by not having to worry about discs. Mm. Like, all of this stuff is great. The market isn't quite ready for it yet. And when the Xbox came out at £430 versus the PS4 that's going to be £349, you can't help but think, man, if you're only buying one, it's clear which one you're buying. And so Microsoft was kind of, there's nothing it could really do but make this decision. I reckon it'll come back. Mm-hmm. I think this is just going to be kind of a launch day thing to kind of defend the PR, to make sure initial sales are there, and basically to make sure that Sony isn't using Microsoft's restrictive decisions as kind of its own marketing tactic, because that's basically what they did in the E3 press conference that I was at. The other thing is, I think this stuff's kind of got to be opt-in. Now, I was having a chat with a friend in a pub the other night, and we were saying that I kind of thought that if you were given the option to register a game to your account, you could be told, you know, you won't necessarily be able to resell this, and you can't necessarily lend this disc to a friend anymore, but you will have this game stored against your account, you know, for the future, and if you move consoles, and basically give that choice to the user.
You can decide,
so they can, you know, for me, I wouldn't necessarily want to do that because, you know, we get sent, you know, promo copies of games for doing the review, and sometimes, you know, you might want to lend a copy to someone, you know, down the line. Whereas if you go out and buy a copy for £50 or whatever, you might want to say, well, I don't know, I'll play this off the disc because I probably will want to sell it when the 8-hour campaign's finished. So it's all very interesting. I think it'll come back, and the response has been pretty good so far from gamers.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in.
Another sort of Xbox story, not to do with the console, but to do with the Kinect. And cockroaches, our friends, the roaches of cock. Yeah. Oh no, that sounds a bit
Whoa.
Wrong, doesn't it? Liat, amazing story here.
It is pretty cool.
What's the dealio?
Well, basically, Kinect and cockroaches have become friends, and it's a match made in heaven. So a team at North Carolina State University have basically hooked up remote-controlled cockroaches, this is a thing you should all know about, to Microsoft Kinect to make controlling the little beasties even more fun. So there's already kind of DIY kits that you can actually buy online to make your own remote-controlled cockroach if you fancy catching one first.
We've talked about this before, I think, haven't we?
We have indeed. We've written about it on the site a few times. But they are thinking that it's actually, you know, it's not just to torture them and laugh and say, haha, look, I can control a cockroach, but we can actually use it for a practical purpose, and that is to map disaster zones and places where people might be trapped in building collapses because the little beasties can go places we cannot. So basically, they controlling the cockroach's movements, first of all, is pretty simple. You just attach a tiny circuitry to the antenna, which does actually involve snipping them off and gluing it on. Not so nice. And the electrical signals are passed down the antenna, which mimics what happens naturally when a cockroach bangs into something and they say, ha, a wall, and they turn and they go another way. So there's actually an app that you can control a cockroach. RoboRoach, I believe, allows you to use this app to control the roach. So the research team have programmed a path and they instructed the cockroach to follow it. And the system monitors its movements as they go along and adjust the electrical stimulation to make sure that they stay on track. So the idea essentially is that one day we will be able to set it to autopilot and the Kinect system will self-correct the cockroach to take it on the most efficient route through the target zone. And eventually they will have little radios fitted and you can chat to said people trapped in disaster zones.
So it's funny you mentioned that in the last
smiling
thing, because I was going to say, I didn't know if you were going to mention that part in your explanation, but my favourite part was at the end of this story, your last sentence, which is actually you didn't write this, did you? I think Philippa wrote this. If the system works, the researchers eventually hope to be able to equip the roaches with communication devices which would allow rescue services to communicate with trapped or injured people. Imagine that. A cockroach walks in front and goes, Nate,
I'm here to help you.
Are you okay? I'd be looking at the floor thinking, what have I inhaled?
Yeah. I think the first thing
have
you
I accidentally
do
done a bit of drugs
when a cockroach runs at you and you're trapped in a building and you can't move is to try and kill it immediately so you don't accidentally get, you know, cockroach all over your face.
Yeah. I think when your limbs are crushed by the
what if
the
you have,
building
if you have a free limb you. You were gonna say that Liv. If you had a free limb, I'd be like, I don't want to be trapped in here with a cockroach.
Yeah, not a
I would eliminate it.
Yeah,
well, it has to talk pretty quickly.
You might not
so
have any arms left. How would you eliminate it?
I don't want to think about this anymore. Let's take this down a dark route.
This is interesting. When are we going to see this? This is all a prototype type thing, isn't
it?
They
are very early stages. And actually, the Robo Roach story that we covered not so long ago, I spoke to one of the guys who works with the cockroaches. And he says that they are actually pretty savvy and they figure out what's going on fairly quickly and will just start tuning out the electrical impulses and ignoring it and going the way they want to go. So they're going to have to basically set it up so that they can, that they're collecting data now so that they can see what is the best route to, you know, how strong that impulse has to be to override the cockroach's little brain.
There was a comment that came in on the site that I thought was a bit over the top, that said that the concept and development of biobots adds yet another deplorable example of the ever-growing list and history of violations of the physical and psychological well-being of humans and non-human animals.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. And then someone actually replied to that and said, yes, tricking a cockroach into changing direction is totally torture. But the thing is, like, there is a point. Like, when you're, like, ripping off antennae in order to insert electricity,
I learned about that when I wrote this piece the other week, and I was like, whoa, guys. You're like, have this cute little name, RoboRoach, but no, you haven't got the video on your Kickstarter page which shows you cutting off its little antenna, putting hot glue on it, sticking it in ice water.
Oh, it sounds delicious. Liv, if you go down to the woods today, you're in for a big surprise, although not anthropomorphized bears eating human food.
That would be good. No amaze bears. It's music. So I have a question for you.
Go on.
If a 24-hour radio broadcast happens in a Scottish forest and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound?
Yes.
Yes, you're right, it does. The man called Stuart McLean in August, or McLean, sorry, is going to be placing an FM transmitter in the middle of the Galloway Forest in Scotland, which is a really, really, really dark forest with very little light pollution. It's actually a very good place to go and do stargazing. And what he wants to do is broadcast for 24 hours music that have never been heard, that has never been heard before from dozens of different artists. And once he's broadcast them once, he's going to delete all the files with the idea of them not being heard again. And so anyone who wants to hear it has to go to this forest. You can't hear it. You won't be able to hear it on regular radio. It's a kind of close, what do you call it? Local
proximity.
Proximity radio. It's an
vicinity.
Whatever it is. You can only hear it within a 3 mile or 5 kilometer radius of the transmitter. And so if you want to hear this music that's never been heard before, you have to go there. And he's managed to get, he did this thing last year with about 3 weeks' notice. And he managed to get some really big names involved, like Severed Heads, The Herbalizer, Dave Clark, Imogen Heap, and Richard X. So they all loved this idea of kind of contributing a song or a piece of music that was potentially only going to be heard by, you know, deer and rabbits.
Are they broadcasting any podcasts?
No, they're not, actually. They might be doing a live gig on the night. It's the 31st of August going into the 1st of September. But yeah, he's kind of looking for people to submit music for this broadcast. He's already got about 8 hours, or at least he did when I spoke to him.
So neat.
And it's including people like Mogwai, Excentronic Research Council and Factory Floor. But he's kind of looking for some more. So, Nate, maybe one of your compositions could be submitted.
Yes, one of mine on iTunes. Search for Nate Langson. It's 79 pence.
But yeah, he's divided the music up broadly into three categories. So some for the evening, some for the dark, and it's really, really pitch black up there. He says that, you know, you put your hand in front of your face and you can't see it. That's why it's so good for stargazing. And also day music. And so he said he had some like dark ambient soundscapes that would work really well in the nighttime, but perhaps in the sun of the day, less appropriate.
Yes.
And something that I quite like he's also going to do is the radio transmitter is going to be on the top of this very, very big hill where there's a huge stone kind of obelisk. And he's going to, all the way up the path to the top of the hill, he's going to place these old like radios, like he's going to pick up from charity shops, and he's going to tune them into the right frequency so that they can hear that's playing the broadcast.
Oh,
and so you'll be able to follow this little path of old radios up to the top where you'll find the kind of source of the music.
That's terrific.
That's better than bears having a picnic.
I think I'm going to email my friend Incredula Filth and say you should definitely get in on this, because there's a definite non-heavy metal bias.
Yeah
those deer.
Absolutely. But if you do have a tune you'd like to contribute, you can email Stuart. He's on frenchbloke@gmail.com.
Of course,
so
he is.
Send in your music.
Well, we're going to have a French break right now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the mystery of the medieval manuscripts. Do you want a free audiobook? Of course you do. You listen to a podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering you, yes, you, any book from its catalogue of 80,000 audiobooks just for being a Wired.co.uk podcast listener. A 1 month free trial of Audible.co.uk costs £0.00, and whatever book you choose to download as part of your trial is yours to keep, even if you cancel the account. So if you head to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up in a few seconds and download any book you want, you'll be supporting our show here every week and you get a free book as a thank you. Not really sure what's not to like about that, so go to audible.co.uk/wired right about now. It's the second half of the show. This is the section where we divide up our news cake and give every slice a different name. And the first is a news segment. It's called, Interesting. And the first story that we filed under Interesting is a mystery story. And that's what this topic's all about. Things that are just a bit bizarre and weird. Liat, a mysterious manuscript has carried a quote-unquote genuine message. What the dilly? I've said that once, but I'm saying it again. What the dilly,
dilly,
yeah, honestly.
I know what you mean. It's called the Voynich Manuscript. I hope that's the right pronunciation. It probably isn't. Thought to have been penned in the 15th or 16th centuries in Italy. Very, very, very romantic period. It's basically remained completely indecipherable this entire time, and people have just got sick of it. They started to suggest this is gibberish, this is not a language, this is a hoax. They've even got these delicately drawn images of plants alongside the text, which appear to be just bizarre imaginary plants. But, you know, maybe they exist somewhere. Maybe we'll find them one day. Now, this nice guy, Marcello Montemuro, has done a statistical analysis and shown that it most likely, in fact, contains a genuine message. I know. It's a big deal. Hundreds of years, people have scoured this text and come up with nada. So basically, this looks like a genuine language when you first look at it. It's got about 19 to 29 symbols in the alphabet, which corresponds with European languages. It has the same word and sentence length of other modern European languages. But it's just been completely unbreakable. Apparently, it's been going around for hundreds of years, and the first kind of known, piece of news about it was when this guy called Wilfred Voynich bought it from Jesuit priests in Italy. An even more romantic element to the mystery. I like this. I like the way it unfolds.
Is there any idea of what this thing might actually correspond to?
Like, literally none. And this, sorry, a psychologist actually came out saying, I think this is a hoax, because back in the day, people would have paid loads of money for kind of bizarre artifacts that they think, I don't know, an alien dropped here in medieval Italy. But this guy, Marcello, was very, you know, methodical about it. He gave each symbol in the alphabet a modern language letter, ran it through a series of algorithms to analyze a different patterns that might emerge. And he found that repetitions of particular letter combinations and positions in words mirrored the same frequencies of modern languages. It's basically far too complex to be a completely made up languages. This, you know, they're very precisely placed. There are real patterns here. But then again, someone might just be seriously messing with us and thought, do you know what? I'm going to make it mimic our language, but I'm going to still talk gibberish.
And this is why we have a segment called Interesting.
I know. I've been scratching my head.
Yeah.
It's quite a pretty manuscript in itself. I think we should just accept it.
Well, if you go on wired.co.uk and do a search for Voynich manuscript, that's V-O-Y-N-I-C-H, you can find pictures from this mysterious thing.
It might have, like, cures to all the world's diseases.
I doubt it.
Plants.
No,
plant
I doubt
pitches
it.
In it.
Okay. I really doubt
some
it.
Kind of
plus, stuff exists now that didn't exist back then, and things are mutated. So, I doubt that. Sorry to burst that wonderful thought, but it's probably not going to happen.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
Our second and final segment for this week's show is the Wired Crystal Ball. Now, we've been peering into our Wired crystal ball for some time. It's a very shiny ball, has lots of great, fascinating things inside it, as we all know. This week, though, hazy image has appeared in its centre that looks quite futuristic and dystopian. Liv, you've been donning the Mystic Meg mask to decipher what this image is.
Yes,
What's the deal here?
Well, the deal here is that this week we had a great feature from Mark Piesing, one of our journalists, and he wrote about an organization that is called Arizona State University's Center for Science and the Imagination.
Interesting.
And what they're doing, this is a team of futurists, engineers and writers, and they're trying to create the moonshot thinking to inspire the next wave of giant leaps of innovation. And they're trying to counter the dark visions of the future that have been portrayed by a lot of modern science fiction. So this is about less of about the zombie apocalypse and more about kind of Thunderbirds ago.
Right.
Because they feel that the science fiction has got so dark that it's kind of inhibiting innovation, because engineers are seeing, you know, visions of apocalypse and they don't necessarily feel inspired to create the next kind of flying car.
How soon do you want to start talking about my opinions on this?
Give me a few minutes, because I'll just tell you where this idea stemmed from.
Okay.
So, one of the contributors to this project is a guy called Liam Young. He's an architect, and he believes that science fiction can kind of help us realise that we can kind of shape the future rather than just accept, just accept the dystopias that have been conveyed. And the idea actually originally stemmed from a debate between, like, turbo science fiction author Neal Stephenson and one of the people at Arizona State University. And Stephenson argued this exact case that we'd lost some scientific and technological ambition, and that engineers and scientists need more techno-optimistic shows and books, things like Star Trek and The Amazing Stories from the last century, which he believes helped to inspire a generation of innovation. And he's responded to this with a project called Project Hieroglyph, and that's a kind of journal that tries to get science fiction writers to work in conversation with scientists and engineers to produce some kind of very optimistic science fiction. But no one wants to watch good stories or read about good stories.
You
want bad
a film
news.
Just about utopia. You'd be like, well, we're not there.
Yeah, it'd be like
I've
loading
just watched
up
2 hours of stuff I can't have.
It'd be like turning on the news and smiling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
you
just
want
bizarre.
Disaster movies.
Mm. Well, so the thing is, there are two ways to look at this. Well, my two ways of looking at it anyway, is that in a way, science fiction's just more realistic. Like, we're living in a world where we could blow ourselves up any minute. Mm. And we have enough nuclear warheads on the planet
counterproductive.
To I'm just saying.
Yeah, you know what? I actually think in some ways it's kind of the reverse psychology of, like, look what could happen. you need to kind of counter this potential future. You know, yeah. You look at the resources will run out and the Earth's going to implode.
But what about stuff like, you know, SpaceX, asteroid mining?
That's exactly the kind of thing that they're yeah. on board with.
Okay, well, that's good because we're doing that. And then, you know, even stuff on the smaller scale that is every day we take for granted now, but really they're changing the way that everyone is going to think about health, let's say. You know, wearable technology, you know, monitoring your blood by swallowing a pill that communicates wirelessly to a little receiver next door. Like, these are all things that yeah. exist. Mm. You know, fascinating stuff. Robotic limbs, prosthesis.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't tend to put those too much in sci-fi, but, like, these things are really happening. And I think the other thing to think about is that, you know, when I think about what people used to think about the future, is all flying cars mm. and stuff like that. And people say, where's my flying car? Where's my hovercraft? Where is my, you know, balance board thing that they had in Back to the Future? I'm ashamed to think I can't remember the name of that now. Hoverboard. Yeah. And people say, like, but really, like, we don't need those. Like, flying cars, we don't need anywhere near as much as more efficient cars that just use wheels that don't suck up oil.
But you say that, though, you know, we wrote recently about the Scanadu device, and everywhere it's been described as the tricorder, which is a Star Trek kind of conceit. And so everywhere is saying it's, you know, a modern day tricorder. It kind of can just do an instant health assessment by you place it against your temple, I think, and it does all your different vitals. Yeah. So I think these kind of fictional ideas can play quite a powerful role, either in just communicating or
yeah,
in inspiring
and
people.
Helping, like, the public trust it more. I think that's part of it as well.
And you said that, you know, we don't have the flying car, we don't have the hoverboard, but actually we did a kind of a retrospective of the Jetsons. I think it was last year they had the 50th anniversary of the Jetsons, and actually of all the things that they came up with, things like a telepresence and you know, I think it was like, you know, the talking computer, the connected home, all of these things we do actually have in some shape or form. You know, whether or not the Jetsons was directly responsible is another thing. But again, what are the kind of Jetsons equivalent of today? I'm sure there are. I don't watch cartoons anymore. But
well, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Is our future being coined by the depressed or the optimistic? That's going to wrap up our news bit of the show. We got some feedback on some stories we talked about earlier. Now, quite a lengthy comment came in about the Google censorship stuff from Simon Anderson in Australia. And I'm reading a truncated version of his comment, but you can read the full comment on that story on wired.co.uk. And he says, Google should never have to censor itself, period. They made a big mistake when they started to cave into demands to stop certain sites appearing in search results. It just panders to the idiots who think that, quote, Google equals the internet. It's like some sort of integrated tool directly connected to websites, which obviously it isn't. He goes on to say then that it's like someone walking around the globe for you and writing a huge book listing whatever they find. They're going to tell you where all the McDonald's are, but they're also going to tell you where the meth labs are. And what right does anyone have to demand that they don't tell you about everything that they find? If you have a problem, close the meth lab.
Powerful.
Yeah, strong sentiments. And I think that in a way, there's an extension of this comment, which is to say that Google could be very good for finding things that we need to get rid of on the internet. Mm. Not necessarily have it pulled from Google, but if Google's discovering it so effectively, then surely that's making the people who are trying to get rid of these websites, it's making their jobs a little easier to discover them and shut them down. We also had a comment that came in from Lee Grange on the forest music stuff. And this just, I laughed out loud when I read this. Normally we talk about quite positive comments, but this one just made me amused. Lee says, I think you should all pull your heads out of your asses. Pretentious load of crap. That means absolutely F all. Instead of disrupting nature, go and do something else where it might actually make a difference. Anti-art. Anti-art there from Lee.
I think he should get in touch with frenchbloke@gmail.com.
Raging comments.
Yeah. Well, if you want to scream a raging comment, or indeed write one politely and take a photo of it and send it to us, you can do podcast@wired.co.uk. Liat is about to tell you other places that you can follow us.
Yes, you can follow us. I haven't got the stuff.
It's on Facebook.
I think you know it.
I know, but yes, didn't you just say @WiredUK?
Yeah, facebook.com/WiredUK and Twitter, we're @WiredUK.
I knew I should have asked Olivia in school so long.
Oh, yeah. God, don't be so mean to me.
Well, we're going to catch you
next. Hating Liat Day.
Don't forget about our Audible offer, audible.co.uk/wired. You've just finished a podcast. Go and enjoy an audiobook. It's free, for goodness sake. And there are loads. And while you're doing that, we're going to prepare for the next week's show, which is when we'll see you next.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.